Good afternoon. You are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3. That's 101.3 on the FM dial. And we're streaming 24 hours a day and 7 days a week at www.freakradio.org. That's freakradio.org. If you want to listen online, you go to our main page at freakradio.org. Click on Listen and follow the instructions for receiving our live streaming link. You can also, as you used to be able to for a long time, you can still also click on the red oval there, and that'll set most of you up. Make sure you have a decent, reliable audio reception program so that you can hear our streaming link.
Forces, the naked attention, the sick metamorphosis, pushing my victims to flatter and fawn me, obeying the dictum of all eyes upon me. The ego's a castle, and I am the sentry, granting the spineless the easiest entry. My simple subjects are eager to bow, so fire up the spit, wheeling the cow. I'm in my element now. In my virtue, the goblet is passed. 54 jesters are kissing my ass. I may be fat, but my belt has to bust before this binging can end. Feeding my their praises, they're nursing me now with their sweet empty phrases. The critics are cleaved from my peace with the mallet. No spoils are received by the king's fragile palate. Stuffing myself on the blind adulation, fed full of self, its intense mastication. The simpleton's choir has taken its place, accolades spewing from each vacant face. Now let's say grace. Toasting my virtue, the goblet is passed. 54 jesters are kissing my ass. I may be fat, but my belt has to bust before this binging can end. Feeding my ego again. The goblet is passed. 54 jesters are kissing my ass. I may be fat, but my belt has to bust before this binging can end. Feeding my ego and toasting my virtue. The goblet is passed. 54 jesters are kissing my ass. I may be fat, but my belt has to bust before this binging can end.
Thank you, Christopher Davis. My man from Minnesota. That was Feeding My Ego from Stu Davis's 1994 Panacea Records record entitled Self Untitled. Feeding My Ego. I like to think of it as the theme song of my program, when in reality it's pretty much the theme song of all Free Radio Santa Cruz's programmers. Feeding My Ego. Get it? Get it? Get it? Hi, this is the Mideast Migraine Show. The Mideast Migraine Show with your host, Ren Tawil, for this Monday, February 2nd. My God, where does the time go? It's 2 Feb at 3:06 in the afternoon, Pacific Standard Time. If that jives with your own personal time-space continuum, then you know that you may call in at any time, and your call will be received, assuming I'm pressing all the right buttons and sliding all the right sliders. Here are the phone numbers, direct to the Free Radio studio. Area code for both of them is 831 for Santa Cruz County, California area, 831. Line 1 is 427-3772. Again, line 1 is 427-3772. And in case we're just all too backed up on line 1, try line number 2, 469-3119. Line 2 is 469-3119. As long as I'm tossing out all these numbers and addresses, consider popping us a check or money order to keep this wonderful Strictly Grassroots Pirate Community Station on the air at all hours, on all days. Please consider sending a donation, which shall be... Don't be confused now. This is not a matching funds deal. I'm simply pointing out that all the programmers of Free Radio Santa Cruz keep this station going with our money. It's worse than being a volunteer operation. Not only do we not get paid, we have to pay in order to do this. It's kind of like a hobby, as someone told me the other day. Kind of like ham radio, but we are not ham radio. At any rate, we need additional funds to keep ourselves viable and preferably in the black as far as the logbooks are concerned. Send your donations to Free Radio Santa Cruz or simply write on the postal mail envelope, FRSC, Post Office Box 7811, Santa Cruz, two words, S-A-N-T-A, and Cruz is spelled C-R-U-Z. California, or the big C and the big A. Zip 95061. I'll give it to you again. FRSC, P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz, or Santa Cruz, as a lot of people around here might call it, California 95061. Okay. Microphone now, you behave. Let's begin today's program. Oh, by the way, I am Ren Tawil. As I said earlier, I am your friendly neighborhood Palestinian American, bringing you the bright, shiny truth as opposed to the bright, shiny side of the Israeli narrative. And I don't mind expressing that to you at all. This show is biased. There's no question about it. Coming to Santa Cruz February 28 at 7 p.m., the general start time for these kinds of events, at the Resource Center for Nonviolence. Christopher Bolin, B-O-L-L-Y-N, journalist and author of Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World. This event at the RCNV is sponsored by the Santa Cruz Peace and Freedom Party. Just to repeat those basic facts again here, Christopher Bolin, journalist and author of Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World, sponsored by Santa Cruz Peace and Freedom Party. I'm going to play you some YouTube videos now where Mr. Boland speaks for himself. Begins with a picture of the cover of the book, Solving 9/11, the original articles.
Hello, my name is Christopher Boland. I'm the author of Solving 9/11, a set of books that contains 11 years of factual research into the terror atrocity of September 11th, 2001. Are you confused by the different claims and explanations about what happened on 9/11? If you are, you are certainly not alone. Whether you are new to the 9/11 truth movement or have been a skeptic since day one, you have probably been confused more than once by the various claims and counterclaims about what really happened. For the average citizen, the subject of 9/11 truth is bound to be confusing. The U.S. government and mass media have relentlessly pushed their unproven version, which is not supported by the evidence at all, while a slew of 9/11 truthers have promoted different explanations. Truth seekers find themselves in a land of confusion. What's one to believe? The official version fails to answer fundamental questions about 9/11, such as why the three towers fell. But this seriously flawed explanation, which is not even physically possible, was used to wage war and change the way we live. Even when we realize that we have been deceived, it's not easy to accept that the government has lied about 9/11. It's very uncomfortable for an American to contemplate that the government has engaged in a massive criminal cover-up and sent thousands of Americans to fight and die in Afghanistan and Iraq based on nothing but a pack of lies. When you discover that the U.S. government and mass media have lied to us about 9/11, you realize that the whole war on terror construct is nothing but a massive fraud. This means that the Bush and Obama administrations are criminal operations at the highest level. So you see why 9/11 truth is a very painful subject to contemplate. It means either you believe the lies and support the fraudulent war on terror, or you basically divorce yourself from the federal government. This is certainly not an easy choice. Even if you have crossed that bridge and understand that the government is lying, the truth of 9/11 is not easily found on the other side. Just the truth seeker trying to make sense of the competing claims about what happened on 9/11 and determine who is responsible may find this effort quite perplexing. There are different theories out there and they can't all be true. So how does one make sense of the different explanations? First, one needs to realize that the 9/11 truth movement is full of disinformation agents whose mission it is to confuse people. To understand why, we need to think like a perpetrator and understand that the people behind the 9/11 cover-up see the truth movement as an enemy that needs to be neutralized. For the perpetrators of 9/11, the truth movement is really only a serious problem when it gets too close to the truth. Their strategy to neutralize the truth movement employs several tactics: maligning the movement, confusing the issue, and attacking those who expose the truth. As an investigative journalist who has researched 9/11 a great deal, I have personally seen how these tactics have been applied. First, skeptics of the official version who raise serious questions about 9/11 are maligned as conspiracy theorists. And as George W. Bush said, we should never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th. The mainstream media, for its part, has maligned and ignored the 9/11 truth movement completely. When the BBC interviewed me in June 2005, their first question was, "Why are you the only American journalist who does not believe the official version of 9/11?" I told them that if that were true, it was probably because other journalists who questioned the official version had been fired. Secondly, competing theories are promoted to confuse people about what caused the destruction at the World Trade Center. The evidence indicates that sophisticated forms of superthermite were used to pulverize the Twin Towers from the top down, leaving nothing but steel and dust. In the dust, chips of an explosive nanocomposite of superthermite were discovered by Stephen E. Jones and a team of scientists. Because this scientific discovery clearly exposes the 9/11 deception, the perpetrators have attacked it by promoting competing theories that claim that mini nuclear bombs or energy beam weapons are responsible for the destruction of the Twin Towers. While these competing theories are far-fetched and not proven, they are useful for the perpetrators because they confuse people and create a division in the truth movement that can be exploited to attack the theory that has been proven, the use of superthermite in the demolition. And thirdly, the perpetrators attack those truth seekers who get too close to the truth. This is why Dr. Jones and I were attacked in the summer of 2006. We were both viciously slandered and prosecuted. We lost our jobs and income. I was brutally attacked by 3 undercover police at my home, and then maliciously prosecuted on charges that I had assaulted them. We are the only 2 9/11 researchers that I know of who have been attacked for our work. The people who promote the competing theories do not face such threats. I was, in fact, a working journalist when I was attacked at my home near Chicago, but not a single journalist or organization of journalists even contacted me about the brutal attack that left me tasered with a broken elbow. The Chicago newspapers reported the incident without even contacting me to get my side of the story. The newspaper I wrote for, the supposedly patriotic American Free Press, suddenly fired me 6 weeks after the attack. I was accused of disloyalty and fired after the paper had collected funds for my legal defense. These, then, are the basic tactics that are used to neutralize the 9/11 truth movement. Malign the movement, confuse the issue, and attack those who expose the truth. The strategy of the perpetrators is to use slander and disinformation to sow suspicion and doubt about those who have discovered the truth. In this way, the perpetrators try to marginalize the importance of these crucial discoveries. But in the end, the perpetrators and their disinfo agents are fighting a losing battle, because while they may delay their day of reckoning, in the end, the truth will prevail. Thank you for listening.
Now again, that is the first of 3 videos that are available on YouTube by Christopher Bolin, a man who has been very fundamental in trying to expose the disinformation campaign around the facts regarding the attacks on the United States in Manhattan and Washington, D.C. on September 11th, 2001. I'm going to play 2 more videos by Mr. Bolin. What you just heard was the disinformation campaign. Here is Solving 9/11, Exposing the Deception.
Hello, my name is Christopher Bolin. I'm the author of Solving 9/11, a set of 2 books that contains the results of my research of the terror atrocity of September 11, 2001. Most Americans would agree that 9/11 changed the nation, especially the relationship between the citizen and the state. What a person thinks about how America has changed in the 12 years since 9/11 depends very much on what a person believes and what a person knows about the terror events that changed America. Roughly half the American population believes the government and media version of what happened on 9/11. If you believe what George W. Bush and Barack Obama say about the terror atrocity, then you probably support the things they have done as a result. This would mean, for example, supporting the so-called War on Terror, with the costly U.S. invasions and occupations of Afghanistan and Iraq, and the military interventions in Pakistan, Yemen, Syria, Somalia, and elsewhere. Defense spending since 2001 has more than doubled, going from $300 billion to more than $700 billion per year. But if you believe what Bush and Obama have said about the need to fight terrorism, then you probably think these wars and defense spending were necessary. In the post-9/11 train that gave us the War on Terror came the USA Patriot Act, the offshore military detention facility in Guantanamo, Cuba, intrusive inspections of travelers, and the increased surveillance of the American people, their phone calls, and private communications. Again, if you believe the government's story about 9/11, then you probably agree that such things are necessary for our security. If, on the other hand, you are in the other half of the population that does not believe the government version of 9/11, then you are probably pretty skeptical about the reasons given for the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. In this case, you probably also have very serious doubts and reservations about the USA Patriot Act, the full-body scans given to people at U.S. airports, and the massive collection of our phone calls, email, and internet records by the NSA. After all, a person who is skeptical of the government explanation of 9/11 is probably equally skeptical of the need to detain people for years on end in places like Gitmo, where more than half the detainees are currently engaged in a hunger strike to protest their illegal detention for more than a decade. Many of these detainees are being force-fed, a brutal act that is considered to be a form of torture. If you are skeptical about what the government says about 9/11, then you are bound to be equally skeptical of the things the government has done based on its seriously flawed explanation of events. If you are among the 40% of the American population that is not satisfied with the government explanation and believes there has been a cover-up of the truth about 9/11, then you would probably agree that the government has intentionally deceived the American people and is involved in a fraud of historic proportions. In this case, you probably think that most of the things the government has done as a result of 9/11 are equally fraudulent. The thing that separates these two groups of people, those who believe the government version and those who don't, is really how much they know about 9/11. For example, 5 years after 9/11, in 2006, 43% of the American population was unaware that there was a third skyscraper that collapsed on 9/11, Larry Silverstein's 47-story World Trade Center 7. Likewise, about half the population believes that Saddam Hussein of Iraq was involved in 9/11, although there's absolutely no evidence to support this. This means that nearly half the American population really has very little understanding of what really happened on 9/11. The same percentage of the population that has no idea of what happened on 9/11 also believes that there was no cover-up. On the other hand, the number of people who are aware of the mysterious collapse of World Trade Center 7 is about the same as the number of people who think there has been a cover-up. This means that the more people know about 9/11, the more likely they are to realize that the government has lied about what happened. This is where my Solving 9/11 books make a real difference. These books contain the facts and information that clearly disprove the government version and reveal the real terrorists behind 9/11 and their motivation for the attacks. Once you have read the Solving 9/11 books, you will no longer be susceptible to the War on Terror propaganda, because you will understand that 9/11 is a hoax meant to deceive the world. While the truth about 9/11 may be disturbing, it is certainly better to know the truth than to be deceived, because to believe something that is not true is to be enslaved by a lie. Something like 85% of the American military forces in Iraq believed that they were fighting because of Saddam Hussein's involvement in 9/11. That is to say that most of the Americans fighting and dying in Iraq were acting and on completely false information. Had they known that Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11, they may very well have made other choices about serving in Iraq. The same goes for the people who served in Afghanistan. Knowing the truth about 9/11 gives you the ability to make better decisions about what you will do in the future. This is just as true for nations as it is for individuals. If the United States, as a nation, is to move ahead and make intelligent choices and policies it has to do so using the truth as its base. To continue to operate and create policies and wage wars based on a pack of lies about 9/11 can only harm the nation. The sooner the deception of 9/11 is exposed on a large scale, the sooner we can return to a normal and sane political state. I think most Americans would certainly prefer the peaceful way of life we enjoyed prior to 9/11. The Solving 9/11 books expose the deception that is at the heart of the massive fraud that has changed America and the world. The books contain more than 11 years of research, much of it original, which makes it very hard to present in a short video of 5 or 10 minutes. What I will try to do going forward is to present certain key elements of my research in a series of short videos. I hope in this way that I can bring the relevant facts and information to more people and hasten the day that we are all free of this awful deception that began on 9/11. Thank you for listening.
The second of three videos, that was video number 2 by Chris Bolin. We will not be getting into the much longer series of videos where he fleshes out the matter in his book entitled Solving 9/11, the original Solving 9/11, the deception that changed the world. I just want to play these three. And by the way, these were released on or around the 4th of July, 2013, about a year and a half ago. And again, Mr. Bolin will be speaking at the Resource Center for Nonviolence on, February 28th, 7 p.m. at the Resource Center for Nonviolence, located at 612 Ocean Street in Santa Cruz, California. Let me just, the first short video we heard, they're all an average of 8 or 9 minutes long. The first one was the disinformation campaign. You just heard exposing the deception, and now a 10.5 minute long closing video for today by Mr. Bolin to whet your appetite for his upcoming visit here in Santa Cruz. Video number 3, Solving 9/11, Destroying the Evidence. Woo!
Hello, my name is Christopher Bolin. I'm the author of Solving 9/11, a set of books that contains 11 years of research into the terror atrocity of September 11, 2001. The book is titled Solving 9/11 because 9/11 remains an unsolved crime. The crime has not been solved because there was no criminal investigation. Most of the evidence was destroyed before it could even be examined. The politically appointed 9/11 Commission and flawed building studies cannot substitute for the missing criminal investigation. It is indeed criminal for the officials responsible for an investigation, in this case the FBI, to allow crucial evidence from the crime scene to be destroyed. This is why I call the federal investigation of 9/11 a non-investigation. While George W. Bush was quick to blame Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda and to invade Afghanistan on the pretext that they were responsible, the Bush administration never presented any evidence to prove that these were in fact the guilty parties. We need to remember that 90% of the nearly 3,000 people who died on 9/11 died during the explosive destruction of the World Trade Center. We now know that the Twin Towers were demolished with extremely powerful military-grade explosives, including a form of nanothermite that was made using nanotechnology. Thermite was evidently the cause of the molten iron seen falling from the South Tower before the building was destroyed. Thermite also created the intensely hot fires that raged beneath the pile of rubble for more than 3 months. These fires were hotter than the boiling point of iron, a fact proven by the huge amount of ultrafine particles found in the smoke rising from the pile of rubble. The explosive coating of superthermite that was found in the dust pulverized the concrete floors and the contents of the Twin Towers and caused the vaporization of some of the structural steel. A peculiar characteristic of the dust from the demolished towers is that it contains billions of tiny droplets of iron that were in the molten state when the towers were destroyed. The official version of why the towers fell fails to explain how these huge amounts of molten iron were created. Had the steel been examined by experts, it would have revealed that the structures had been demolished by explosives and superthermite. This discovery would have exposed the whole 9/11 deception. If Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda did not put superthermite in the Twin Towers, who did? The evidence had to be destroyed because 9/11 was a criminal deception that was not meant to be solved. In such a false flag terror operation, it is essential for the culprits to destroy the evidence to protect the fraud and the real terrorists behind it. A proper criminal investigation begins with a forensic examination of the evidence. In the case of the World Trade Center, dust and steel were virtually all that remained after the demolition. Van Romero of New Mexico Tech, a demolition expert, told the press on 9/11 that the towers were probably brought down with explosive devices that had been placed in the buildings. Numerous eyewitnesses reported seeing and hearing explosions. So why didn't the FBI examine the steel for evidence of explosives? Bill Manning, the editor of Fire Engineering magazine, protested the destruction of the steel from the World Trade Center in December 2001, saying, "The destruction and removal of evidence must stop immediately." In spite of the obvious need to preserve the evidence, the hasty destruction of the steel continued apace, around the clock, 24/7. The crucial steel was destroyed as quickly as possible, cut up into small pieces, mixed with other scrap metal, and shipped to steel mills in Asia. While there were stories in the New York Times about the recycling of the steel, it was never presented for what it really was: the destruction of the crucial evidence from the worst mass murder in U.S. history. The question of who was responsible for allowing the evidence to be destroyed was never discussed, leaving the reader with the impression that this was all just part of a heroic cleanup effort to get New York City back on its feet. Because 9/11 was an act of terror, the investigation and prosecution were conducted by the Department of Justice, namely by Assistant Attorney General Michael Chertoff, who oversaw the criminal division of the department. The FBI is the department's agency responsible for the collection and examination of the evidence. Michael Chertoff, the Israeli son of a Mossad officer, is the dual national who supervised the FBI's collection of the evidence. He was the person responsible for the prosecution of the crimes of 9/11. In this key position, Chertoff allowed the crucial steel evidence to be destroyed by simply passing it on to officials from New York City's government, who then had it sent to two scrap yards across the river in New Jersey, Hugo Noy and Metal Management, where it was quickly cut up and shipped to Asia. What is most noteworthy about this network is that the steel evidence passed from one Zionist agent to another, from Chertoff all the way to China. Instead of preserving the evidence, the steel, for example, Chertoff passed it along to Richard Shearer, the commissioner of Mayor Giuliani's Office of Emergency Management. Shearer was dubbed the Jewish Knight of the 9/11 cleanup effort by the rabbis of New York. In what is described as a backroom decision, the responsibility to remove the steel was passed on to Kenneth Holden, the head of the city's Department of Design and Construction. This was the informal chain of command that resulted in what is described as the most aggressive possible schedule of demolition and debris removal. The hasty and aggressive cleanup effort was really the organized and pre-planned destruction of the evidence. The company that carried out the debris removal was Bovis Lendlease, a British company, headed by a Jewish immigrant from Czechoslovakia named Frank Lampl. Lampl also happens to be an ardent Zionist, a supporter of Israel, and a friend of Ehud Barak, a senior Israeli military commander and suspect in the 9/11 crimes. Bovis began working on the debris removal on September 12th. Most of the steel was taken by truck and barge to one of two New Jersey scrapyards, Hugo Neu or Metal Management. Both were Zionist-owned and controlled junkyards. Hugo Neu, a family-owned junkyard, handled the bulk of the steel. At Hugo Neu, there were two Belgian Israelis who had been sent by Mark Rich to create a global trading division which would manage the shipping of the steel to Asia. Mark Rich is the notorious Israeli criminal who was pardoned by Bill Clinton on his very last day in office. In the months before 9/11, the Claremont Channel to Hugo Neu's junkyard was dredged to allow ocean-going vessels to reach the scrapyard. Hugo Neu paid $24 million to clear the channel for the ships that would then take the steel from the World Trade Center to Asia, at a time when the price of scrap steel was at its lowest point in 50 years. Why didn't they save money by simply selling the steel to U.S. mills instead of shipping it halfway around the world to Asia? Metal Management Northeast was the name of the other junkyard, which had been a family-run outfit until it was taken over in 1998. In the months before 9/11, Metal Management itself was taken over by CIBC World Markets, an Israeli-run investment fund headed by Lior Bregman, an Israeli military analyst who is connected to the same group of people that are involved in other aspects of the 9/11 crime. The crucial steel evidence from the World Trade Center that should have been preserved and examined by experts was taken to junkyards that were owned and controlled by Israelis or dedicated supporters of the State of Israel. Michael Chertoff, the person who was responsible for the investigation and prosecution of 9/11, is the person who allowed the evidence to be destroyed. He is also an Israeli by birth. If Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda were truly responsible for the death and destruction at the World Trade Center, why would Israelis and Zionists work so hard to destroy the evidence? That Zionists would destroy the evidence and cover up the truth of 9/11 does not make sense until you put all the pieces together and see that the terror attacks were a Zionist false flag operation that was meant to be blamed on Muslims and Arabs in order to kickstart the Zionist plan war on terror. This is not an opinion based on speculation. This is what the facts indicate. For more details on how the whole operation was carried out, read Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World, and Solving 9/11, the original articles. Thank you for listening.
It says here, learn more, buy the books. Better back that up a bit here.
Thank you for listening.
Learn more, buy the books. Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World. And the second book he mentioned was Solving 9/11, The Original Articles. You may buy them at www.bolin.com. That's BOLLYN.com. Bolin.com. Music, incidentally, from freesoundtrackmusic.com. And, of course, as I indicated, Mr. Bolin will be in town February the 28th. And let's see here, February 28th. My guess is that's, I don't have a calendar in front of me, but I'm offhand, I would say that it's a Sunday. Let me see what I got here on the old instant calendar. Saturday, 28 February, that is a Saturday. Happens to be the last day of the month, of course, this non-presidential year. 7 p.m. at the Resource Center for Nonviolence, which is located at 612 Ocean Street. That's 612 Ocean Street in Santa Cruz, California. Christopher Bolin, journalist and author of Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World. Sponsored by the Santa Cruz you read in there. Sponsored by Santa Cruz Peace and Freedom Party, Peace and Freedom Political Party. And to emphasize, these are three videos that you've been listening to over the last half hour. Not meant to tell the whole story, obviously. And yes, of course, this was forwarded to me as a promotion for Mr. Bolin's tour and appearance. And many people will simply want to pass off as an opportunity for him to sell more books, sign them, autograph them, and spread the other form of disinformation. But at least you know he's going to be appearing February 27th. 7 p.m. at 612 Ocean Street. The videos are not meant to tell the whole story by any means. They are obviously a general description of what the books are about, what he's about, and to some degree, what his talk's going to be about. This is very exciting, and I am, after remaining almost completely silent on the 9/11 issue for the 2.5 years, that I've been doing this program on Free Radio Santa Cruz, I am all too happy to finally begin to talk about it in a more outward and forthright manner. I was very tempted to play. I mean, I can take up all my shows just by playing a bunch of YouTubes, interviewing countless people involved with the 9/11 truth movement, the real 9/11 explanation of what really happened and who was really behind it. There were many more videos lined up there, 10, 15, 5 minutes long, and some more than an hour long. But maybe another day for some of those. All right, you are listening to the Mideast Migraines program for a Monday, February 2, 2015, on Free Radio Santa Cruz. We broadcast at 101.3 FM and stream live at freakradio.org. Let's get into some of this other exciting, interesting, fascinating recent stuff here from, let's see, from Stop the JNF. JNF stands for the Jewish National Fund, which has been active in Palestine since the beginning of the previous century, since around 1900, 1901. The JNF, the Jewish National Fund, this is from the Stop the JNF campaign. Fight greenwashing. We got another washing term here. Fight greenwashing and Green Sunday by supporting the Plant a Tree for Palestine campaign. Planting trees is a daily act of resistance and survival for Palestinians amidst ongoing colonization and greenwashing by the JNF. Every year, the Jewish National Fund, the JNF, desecrates the Jewish New Year for trees. Tu B'Shvat. Tu B'Shvat, with its, quote, Green Sunday events that it uses to promote the selling of trees to plant over land stolen from Palestinians. Join the Stop the JNF campaign in exposing the JNF's greenwashing while replanting Palestinian trees. While replanting Palestinian lands that have had 1,000-year-old olive trees, in other words, native indigenous trees, uprooted by the JNF and the Israeli military. Several points here. Plant a tree in Palestine. Help replant Palestine with olive trees native to the region. Organize a screening of Enduring Roots, Over a Century of Resistance to the Jewish National Fund. Read and share IJAN's ebook on the JNF, Greenwashing Apartheid, the Jewish National Fund's Environmental Cover-Up, and visit the new Fall Donors website to sign the petition to renounce previous support for the JNF and instead pledge to work for justice for all. You may also provide testimony of your transportation from JNF supporter to fallen donor. Okay, I'm obviously reading from a big, it's an action alert. A lot of these are generally headlined as an action alert to the Free Palestine, Stop the JNF campaign. And it's kind of somewhat embarrassing and a clumsy situation here when I'm reading from these beseechments that are indicated on the email as a link to another site. That's the website is stopthejnfcampaign.us@gmail.com. I'll say it again. This is the email address. stopthejnfcampaign.us@gmail.com. Their website is www.stopthejnf.org. That's one of the handy things about comparing websites with email addresses is they're often virtually identical. The website is stopthejnf.org. Here, now let's get into the real meat of this here. What is the JNF? For more than 100 years, the JNF, Jewish National Fund, has been complicit and integral in the systematic expulsion of Palestinians from their homes and villages under the guise of, quote, environmentalism, quote, Jewish values, and, quote, making the desert bloom. The JNF has co-opted the sacred Jewish practice of planting trees and repurposed it to create and further entrench the Zionist project of building a Jewish state in Palestine. With forests of, this is important, now listen to this rather scientific take, with forests of invasive, rapid growth tree species of eucalyptus and alpine pine, not native to that part of the world, planted over stolen land, the JNF works to ensure that Palestine is populated with a Western landscape, or recreational parks and forests created for explicitly Jewish use, leaving Palestinian refugees with little left to return to of their villages and land use practices. The JNF's racist brand of environmentalism is at the heart of Israel's colonization of Palestine. The environmental devastation left in its wake is the inherent consequence of the violent extraction of natural resources needed to fuel a colonial and militarized society gone mad on war and occupation. What is Tub Shvat here? I've tried to pronounce that, perhaps somewhat mangling it. The way it's spelled in English, in the English transliteration from Hebrew, is T-U, second word B, apostrophe, S-H-V-A-T. I would say Tub Shvat, or Tub Shvat. Beginning on the day that marks the new year for trees, Tuesday, February 3, tomorrow, is the Jewish holiday of Tu B'Shvat, which honors the sacred miracle of trees. In many Jewish traditions, trees are celebrated as one of the most central symbols of life. And in Jewish law, there are strict prohibitions against destroying trees. How does the JNF desecrate Tu B'Shvat? In the late 1800s and early 1900s, leaders of the religious Zionist movement began a custom of planting trees in Jewish colonies in Palestine as part of a celebration of Tu B'Shvat. In 1901, this tradition was then adopted by the JNF for its Plant a Tree in Israel campaign. Since then, the JNF has shamelessly exploited Tu B'Shvat as an opportunity to raise international funds and support for its tree plantings, which function to greenwash Israel's ethnic cleansing of Palestine. There is a photograph here of a caterpillar, big yellow machine, a lengthily extended scoop, you know, a shovel here, a mechanical shovel, uprooting an entire olive tree. This strikes me as particularly hideous. The caption is, Israel's ongoing displacement of Palestinians includes the destruction of cultural and economic means of survival, of which olive trees are central. I've spoken about this several times on this program. Okay, what is Green Sunday? Around the world, the JNF, again, Jewish National Fund, uses its major fundraising campaign, what it calls Green Sunday, on February 1 and February 8, which intentionally falls near Tu Shvat, to build international, public, and financial support for Israel. The JNF coordinates Green Sunday fundraising events and branches in other Western settler colonial states, such as the United States, Canada, and Australia, which enables and normalizes the JNF's manipulation, conflation of Jewish holiday with support for Israel's colonial brand of environmentalism. Now, what is the Stop the JNF campaign? The Stop the JNF campaign has helped organize efforts to replant indigenous trees and agriculture in Palestine through the Plant a Tree Project, a collaboration with Stop the Wall Palestinian Grassroots Anti-Apartheid Campaign, Palestinian Farmers Union, Middle East Children's Alliance, MECCA, and the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network, IJAN. The campaign is now working with the Land Defense Coalition in Palestine to plant 5,000 trees in 2015. And, of course, speaking, the Land Defense Coalition in Palestine is interested in replanting native indigenous olive trees to that part of the world. Please join with the Stop the JNF campaign and our partners to plant indigenous trees in Palestine this May 2015 as part of Stop the JNF. Okay, a very personal note here. Of course, I find the efforts of these people to be highly laudable, and totally right on in terms of identifying the current problem. But I'm going to go ahead and say, I personally am still not at all inclined to contribute to this campaign. Here I am asking people to pay attention to this request for donations and attention from people who find this interesting. But I'm going to tell you, the state of Israel, the Zionist, ostensibly Jewish-only state of Israel, has been engaged for many years, for decades actually, of uprooting and destroying native olive trees. They have uprooted and destroyed literally over 1 million olive trees over the past 66, 67 years. And I consider this effort as noble and as engaging as it sounds to be a drop in the bucket. They're going to plant a few olive trees, many of which are probably destined to be uprooted and destroyed or covered over in their infantile state by further Jewish settler expansion or establishment and expansion of Israeli Zionist Israeli military bases, etc. At least, probably the most important thing is to stop the JNF campaign is bringing attention to what Israel is doing, and that is the real value in my mind. And but, you know, within a year or so, who knows, I'll probably be there myself helping to plant some of these trees. But I got to admit, folks, hey, you know, over 1 million trees uprooted, replaced by alpine and various other conifers that don't belong in that part of the world. It's not part of God's, as it were, design for Palestine and southwestern Asia, the Holy Land, whatever you want to call it. I tend to believe that there are going to be other more important ways that people can contribute to the liberation of Palestine and exposing Israel for what it really is, exposing the Zionist project for what it really is. But I, at least, I can't say that I didn't bring this to your attention. This is the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz, and it's 3:55 p.m. Pacific Time. This program comes to you every Monday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. There is also a second Mideast Migraines program brought to you by Free Radio Santa Cruz every Saturday, the Saturday edition, 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, 11 a.m. on Saturdays, and I'm going to be finishing up. I'm down to the last chapter, the epilogue of the book Freedom Sailors that I've been reading for the past 3 months, describing in detail the first successful voyage of outside, away from Palestine and Israel boats into the Gaza Strip in 41 years. This happened in the summer of 2008. A story very important for me personally because I was there, I participated, and Freedom Sailors will be closing the reading of that book this Saturday, which would be the 7th, February 7th, at 11 a.m. Pacific time, reading the last chapter, short chapter, and a few other vital notes at the end of that book. I have a very, very apparently fascinating, I haven't looked at it carefully, but a book by Anna Baltzer, Witness in Palestine, will be the next reading on the Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. That will take place a week from Saturday, but let's make sure you join me on Saturday at 11 in the morning, 11 a.m., to close up Freedom Sailors. And that's what's going on Saturday. The archives for this program, Mideast Migraines, are available at another website, radioforall.net. That's radio, R-A-D-I-O, the number 4, the character 4, A-L-L.net, radioforall.net, radioforall.net, to get to the archives of my previous readings and various other programs, going back to the beginning of when I began doing this show in the late spring of 2012. Over two and a half years, folks. The archives are there. You may also send your one-way communication to me at MideastMadness@gmx.com. The program is currently called Mideast Migraines. The email address is MideastMadness@gmx.com. MideastMadness@gmx.com. Okay. Musical break here. Back to old Stu Davis again. You just can't get enough of old Stu.
That's where genius lies, covert to the cautious eye, weak and fragile unity. taste of immortality. And the mind unbound, that's when John had found silence is married to sound. His departures were reviled, but the ignorant aren't easy to convert. John was still content to spend a lifetime afraid of rupture, static orthodox, with a brilliant structure which the masses libel, refuse to sanction for the abstract style. It's broken ranks in bad master builder. His ideals were so unyielding, kept his self-respect and lost his shirt. Let's all prepare to make our new pariah.
Oh, shame on me for not playing more Middle Eastern music. After all, one can expect one to remain in the general vein of the subject matter of the program if they want to keep their listeners. Let me spray my mouth here. Got to maintain the old health of the larynx and the voice box. Larynx and voice box, it's the same thing, isn't it? Okay, what else do we have for you tonight? This is the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 FM, streaming live at freakradio.org. And a reminder that Free Radio is going to be celebrating its 20th year of liberating the airwaves since 1995. That's next month, in March. We don't know exactly what yet, but we're going to be having some kind of a celebration. And, you know, being the shoestring hanging by a thread operation that this is, it's often a struggle, a frustrating struggle to keep going on a day-to-day basis as it is. So who knows what form the celebration will take place in or around March of this year. It's already next month. 20 years, folks, of keeping you abreast of what's going on in the world and locally, bringing you some of the best of truly engrossing and in-depth news and documentaries, discussions, not to mention all the wild, crazy music, including some older stuff, wild and crazy, once in a while on Free Radio Santa Cruz. I don't want to give the impression that it's just a bunch of talk. We have some really fascinating tunes for you as well. And all with absolutely no adherence to the rules of the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, not just because we're a bunch of pirate assholes, but because the fact is, face it, FCC is one of the most governmentally corrupt and government-controlled and influenced outlets of the 1% that there is out there. The corporations generally control the content of Western American media and the media of pretty much every other country in the world. And we are taking a 24/7 service providing a welcomed relief from that kind of control. Yes, indeedy. All right, more Mideast Migraine Show. My name is Ren Tawil, your friendly neighborhood Palestinian-American with his own unique form of bias about what's going on in the ostensible Holy Land. That was the... Okay, well, let's begin at the top of this list here. Forwarded by my good bud, Daryl. Let's see what this is about. At Tabi Checkpoint in the West Bank of Palestine. American Union members called to solidarity with oppressed Palestinian workers. This is what that is about. Whoops. I'm Stanley Heller. It's talk reading from this dispatcher. I'm Stanley Heller. I've been a member of the American Federation of Teachers since 1969. I'm a former local president and a member of the Greater New York Central Labor Council for over 40 years. I think we, as union brothers and sisters, should take up this issue. Here's what's going on. On December 31st, Ahmad Sami Badir was lined up at the checkpoint trying to get to his job as a construction worker. The workers have to go through a series of gangways with bars up to the ceiling. They wait hours in an area that's a virtual cage, worried about getting to work late. It was overcrowded as usual. Again, folks, they're describing life for the Palestinian native Arabs in the West Bank of Palestine. 39-year-old Badir couldn't breathe. Workers around him realized he had been crushed to death. He was the second Palestinian crushed to death in 2014 at that very same Al-Tabi checkpoint. Palestinians on the West Bank are desperate to even find low-paying jobs. So, some 40,000 Palestinians go through the humiliating and dangerous checkpoints every day to get to work in Israel. It's outrageous, says American Union member Stanley Heller here. Picture of the cage at Al-Tabi, and it's absolutely no exaggeration, folks. This, what they're showing here is an enclosed area, outdoors, meant to maintain a line of workers waiting to go to work, snaking around, and this thing is hideous. It is a metal, like a giant chicken wire coop, strewn all along the top with razor or barbed wire. And it's just so obvious that the inhumaneness of this. He goes on to say here, as union members, we say an injury to one is an injury to all. Let's get our unions to send angry letters to Israeli officials, the U.S. media, and the politicians. As Americans, we have a special responsibility because our tax money goes to pay for what Israel does. We send the Israeli government over $3 billion a year. It pretends to be a democracy that respects human rights, but it treats Palestinian workers much like workers retreated in old apartheid South Africa. Just go to www.thestruggle.org. That's thestruggle.org/protest, and I'll let you figure the rest of it out for there. That will provide you with a model resolution that could be passed by your union. And for more information about workers and checkpoints, including an Israeli TV video about the Bethlehem checkpoint, email me, Stanley Heller, if you'd like to sign on to the call above to be sent to labor officials, labor papers, and other media. Here's his address, stanley.heller. @att.net. That's Stanley, Stanley, Heller. Stanley.Heller@att.net. Since I've retired, by the way, I've become the executive director of the Middle East Crisis Committee. Their website is www.thestruggle.org. Thestruggle.org. A few quotations here that Mr. Heller provides after the article. Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. From first uttered by Sir Walter Scott. Every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. That is not a way of life at all in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron. Who said that? None other than Dwight D. Eisenhower. In his farewell address, his farewell speech to the American people. I'm going to read that quote from Dwight Eisenhower again. This is an American president who said that every gun that is made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, those who are cold and are not clothed. This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron. You know, for all the contempt that I may hold for the current Republican Party and its antics, its constant sabotaging of the American political and congressional process, I have to hand it to Mr. Eisenhower, President Eisenhower. He has some real doozies that go back quite a ways. In time of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. In time of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act, uttered by George Orwell, the author. Good old Eric Blair. There is no flag large enough to cover the shame of killing innocent people. Quotation from Howard Zinn. One more that I'm going to throw at you here. Stay Human by Vittorio Aragone. The late Vittorio Aragone, whom I sailed to the Gaza Strip with in August of 2008. Okay. It's 4:13 p.m. this Monday, February 2nd, 2015. Mideast Migraine Show, you're hearing from. Let me just say one more thing about donating to this vital radio service to our community and to the world through our online streaming service, free at that. If you do decide to donate money to Free Radio and actually send some in, be absolutely assured that the money is not going strictly to the Mideast Madness program. If you have any problems with this program, or with me, or what I say, just because I'm uttering this request for monetary donations does not mean that the money comes directly to the show. It goes to Free Radio Santa Cruz. We don't even bother having anything like a program-oriented designation of funds. We just hold up the whole service. That's the way that it goes. So don't worry about supporting me or supporting this program if you're in disagreement with the whole operation. Speaking of which, let me take a quick look here. Who all is listening to us? See, I can do that because I have the magic box here. And, yet more listeners. That's nice. Okay. What do we have coming up here? The next moment is 4:15 p.m. Of course, in over the past week, I've spoken of this whole business about Israel's Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu coming to speak to Congress, which in itself, by the way, is a vivid example of how when you've got a president who has the audacity and the courage to stand up to the lead soaker upper of American taxpayer money that goes directly to Israel's military. It's all military aid, designated military foreign aid, not general foreign aid, to Israel, to the state of Israel. And our president refusing, for the time being, to invite, let alone meet, or to meet, let alone invite, Netanyahu to come. We've got a Congress which is kowtowing to the AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which is really a political action committee. In my mind, that's what AIPAC stands for. Congress kowtowing to this man and circumventing the wishes of our American president. And all in an expression of support for Israel's desire to make war upon Iran because of Iran's, quite frankly, historically stubborn stance on opening up the details of its nuclear program. That is true, but the important thing is over the past few years, particularly over the past 12 months, roughly, Iran has been highly cooperative, relatively speaking, with U.S. and Western desires to talk about this, to negotiate their stance, Iran's stance, Tehran's stance, on its nuclear power program. And that has been highly successful. The fact that there is dialogue in Israel, and Netanyahu in particular, seems to hate the notion of dialogue with Persians, with Iranians, with the government of Iran. So, blah, blah, blah. Let's... I think I read this over the past 7 days or so. I'll just read it again. Democrats in the House and the Senate are telling Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that he ought to cancel his planned speech to Congress. This is reported by the Israeli news periodical Haaretz. Democrats in the House and Senate are telling Netanyahu that he ought to cancel his speech. Democratic Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi did not rule out the possibility that many Democratic lawmakers would boycott Netanyahu's speech if it is not canceled, Haaretz says. Asked if most House Democrats would attend the speech if it goes forward, Pelosi said, I don't know. Oregon Democratic Representative Earl Blumenauer has publicly called for the speech to be canceled, a Democratic representative, and has said that if it is not canceled, he will not attend. I will refuse to be part of a reckless act of political grandstanding, Representative Blumenauer wrote in the Huffington Post. Went on to say, I will not participate in a calculated slight from the Speaker and the House leadership to attack necessary diplomacy, end quote. And they're asking me to stand with Leader Pelosi and Representative Blumenauer, urge your representatives in Congress to call for the speech to be canceled, Netanyahu's speech to be canceled, and to pledge not to attend if it is not canceled. This is a petition at Move On. www.justforeignpolicy.org/act/boycottBibi's bluster. justforeignpolicy.org/act/boycottBibi's bluster. Bibi is B-I-B-I-S. Boycott Bibi's bluster, all separated by hyphens. Representatives Keith Ellison of my former district in Minneapolis, Minnesota, Steve Cohen, and Maxine Waters are circulating a letter to Speaker Boehner, the Republican Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, urging that the speech be postponed until after the Israeli elections. That's the other vital thing. This is another reason why this is a terrible slant against both the president and the American people. This is a violation of appropriate protocol not to powwow with leaders of foreign countries in such an in-depth and official manner shortly before national elections in the guest speaker's country. Urge representatives in Congress to stand with leaders Pelosi, Leader Pelosi and Representatives Blumenauer and Ellison by signing and sharing the petition. I can boycott Beebe's bluster, foreignpolicy.org. Thanks for all you do to defend diplomacy. Okay, what's next? Well, folks, guess what? Ion Pape, a native Israeli Jewish man who has been ousted from his native land of Israel for speaking the truth. Ilan Pape, on the Nakba of Palestine. Nakba is the Arabic word for catastrophe, which occurred in 1948 and effectively is an ongoing catastrophic existence for native Palestinian Arabs. Historian Ilan Pape of Exeter University discusses the people and ideology behind the crimes of the war of 1948, which he describes as the ethnic cleansing of Palestine. Let's take a listen. I do not know how long this is, so this may very well take us to the end of the program. It's 22 minutes past 4 p.m. We officially go until 4:55. Here is Ilan Pape in a speech on August 19, 2010, folks. 4.5 years ago. Ilan Pape. Alternative Focus presents Ilan Pape on the Nakba of Palestine.
In May 2008, Al-Awda, the Palestine Right to Return Coalition, hosted its 6th annual international convention in Anaheim, California, to mark the 60th year of a Nakba, which is Arabic for the catastrophe, and refers to the events of 1948, when 750,000 Palestinians were dispossessed of their lands and property.
This speech, by the way, occurred at the Embassy Suites Hotel in Anaheim, California, Anaheim South Embassy Suites, at the 6th annual Al-Awda Convention. I believe he mentioned that. Palestine, 60 years of forced exile. Time for return.
Dr. Ilan Pape is professor of history at Exeter University in England. He is one of the world's leading historians of the Middle East. Among his publications are Britain and the Arab-Israeli Conflict, The Making of the Arab-Israeli Conflict, The Modern History of Palestine, One Land, Two Peoples, The Modern Middle East, and The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. He is the fulcrum of a group of historians and political scientists at the Cornwall campus of Exeter University, working on 20th century ethnopolitics. The following is the speech delivered by Dr. Ilan Pape at the opening ceremony of the Al-Awda Convention.
Of course, I did agree to the change of the title, and in solidarity with the protest and the objection, of course, to the Israeli attempt, I'll do it. But I feel a bit embarrassed about this change because actually I wrote a whole book in which I claim that the term Nakba is not a good term. So you really got me into trouble here, but I'll say that I willingly changed it in order to face the Israelis, but I will change it back to my original title so that I could give the lecture that I wanted to give. And one of the reasons I find the term Nakba disappointing in a way, although I can fully understand its significance and its power as galvanizing for ages and generations the Palestinian memory and activity, is that it's a term of passivity. It's a disaster. It talks about a disaster, and indeed what happened in 1948 was a disaster, but also the tsunami is a disaster, and an earthquake is a disaster. And there are all kinds of disasters. And what in the human psyche associates with disaster usually is that nobody is responsible for it. Everybody is a victim of it. And this is not what happened in 1948. It was not that kind of a disaster. What happened in 1948 is a crime. So there are criminals, and those are those who are victims of that crime. And therefore, the term I chose for my book, the ethnic cleansing, was to attract attention to the crime itself and to say this happened because a certain group of people decided to do it, and it affected a certain group of people. And all of these people, those who decided to commit the crimes, those who were affected by the crime, are all known to us. And for 60 years we didn't even name them. We named the victims, but we never named the people who committed the crime. Yes, we called it sometimes the Zionist movement, we called it the Jewish people, we called them the Israelis, but it's far more precise than that. In fact, it's more justified and more politically sound to talk about the people who decided upon the crime and to find out what ideology motivated them to commit the crime, rather than have vague concepts that usually do not allow us to focus our activity in the right direction. I would like tonight to pay attention and focus on three aspects of what happened in 1948 and have a dialogue, conduct a dialogue with you with the present. I would go back and forth from the past to the present on three different levels in order to find why the memory of what happened in 1948, why the history of what occurred in 1948 is so important for understanding what goes on today and is very crucial for understanding what should be done in the future. I will talk about the Zionist ideology as it appears in 1948. I will talk about the international community reaction to the events of 1948, and I will carefully say something about the Palestinian politics in 1948 and what can we learn from it today as well. Let me start with the Zionist ideology in 1948 and its relevance to what we see today. 1948, in many ways, was a culmination of an ideological process which led to an articulation of a very clear formula, concept, which stated that there is no hope for a successful Zionist colonization of Palestine without the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians. This concept was not born in one day. It was not always there at the very beginning of Zionism, although there were some fluid ideas about it. It was formulated clearly in the mid-1930s, and it was translated into a policy in 1948. We know now from the historical evidence exactly who were the people who formulated these ideas, who were the ones who put forward in a very clear language, with a very clear thinking, the plan to expel by force as many Palestinians as possible from as much of Palestine as possible. The importance of these names is that they are the heroes of Israel today. They all can be found in a pantheon of Israeli heroism. In order to understand what we are facing when we deal with the ethnic cleansing as a crime and the people who directly conceived it, directed it, commanded it, not only the people who executed it on the ground, but the people who really thought out all the details and had the terrible foresight that it can work. When we think about the people who are involved, when we mention the names, we have to understand that we are counting, that we are pointing out to the people who are at the heart of the Zionist consensus today. These are people that most Americans know by heart and revere them as great heroes of humanity, democracy, enlightenment, and modernity. And this is very important, and I think this is why it's so important to know who they were. And I will mention just one of them, because the others appear in my book. The founding father of modern Israel, David Ben-Gurion, is the arch criminal. He is the one who really led the whole operation from beginning to end, which ended with the destruction of more than 500 Palestinian villages, 11 towns, and the dispossession of so many people from their homeland. So the Zionist ideology is the motivating force, but you needed human beings, you needed people who would have, who would execute, who would translate the ideology into actions on the ground. And as it is important to fight an ideological mindset, it's also important to know who are the people who are captivated by this ideology, and to see if today we can identify who is behind the Israeli policies of ethnic cleansing that continue, rather than talk generally about Israel, Zionism, Jews, and so on. I think for the sake of building the future state that I think we all want to build, we should be very careful not to generalize and rather focus on the people. As much as we don't want to think everybody in the world that President Bush represents Americans wherever they are. So I think in this respect it's very important to study 1948 in minute details, not just as a general story. It's to find out when, where, and who was involved in the crime, as good detectives should do in any kind of a crime. The ideological interpretation of Zionism that these leaders and generals had was that you need very particular circumstances in order to be able to commit a crime of this magnitude. It's not expelling one village. It's not destroying one town. It's not throwing out 100 people, 1,000 people from the houses. It is a decision to uproot a whole country. Very few politicians and generals in modern history and even in ancient history were that bold to believe that they are that powerful, that they can be that cruel to decide to take a whole country and depopulate it. We have to ask ourselves, how come Jews 3 years after the Holocaust could have been so callous, so determined in committing a crime of such a magnitude? So I think the first lesson we learn by looking at the connection between Zionist ideology, the people who decided about the ethnic cleansing and the operation on the ground, the first lesson I learned, at least from the history, which is relevant to today, is that we should focus our campaign on names and people and not be satisfied with vague concepts. We are not fighting something which we cannot see. of course we are. I am an anti-Zionist. So we can say we are fighting Zionism, we are fighting Israel, maybe we are fighting a certain group of Jews, and so on. But we should be much more specific of what we are doing. We are fighting people who are criminals. And we know their crimes. And we are going to be professionals about it, not just emotional about it. There was one moment of grace in Britain, which I think showed us the way, when General Almog, who was the chief commander in the Gaza Strip and came to a shopping journey to Oxford Street in London, had to stay with the cleaners on the El Al aeroplane because a professional group of activists told the British authorities that they would ask for his arrest for war crimes, and he didn't want to risk it. So we should learn the nature of the crimes today as we know the nature of the crimes of yesteryears. We should know the names of the people involved in it, because we have very little chance of moving forward if we will adopt a very vague language about who is doing what to whom. We should know the name of the victims. We should know the name of the location where the crimes are being committed. We should appear, I think, to be very serious about it and to tell people that, like the Spanish judge who haunted Pinochet on every corner in Europe and try to bring him to justice, we will haunt the people the moment we would know who they are. We want the names of the pilots. We want the names of the pilots who drop bombs on the Palestinians in Gaza Strip. We are not fighting the Israeli Air Force. We want the name of the pilots. We want the name of the... And nobody here knows, I can assure you. Nobody here knows the names of the Israeli commander of the Air Force. But he is an arch criminal. And you don't know his name. You should know his name as much as you should know the names of his victims if you want to succeed politically. It's not enough to talk about Israel is committing crimes. It's like talking about America committing crime. It never moved anything, these vague languages. I think we should know that. It's easier to do it as an historian for 1948, I admit. But I think there is a model here that we should adopt for activity and action in the present and in the near future. The second point of view, second aspect of 1948, which is relevant, is the international community's reaction to what happened in 1948. There was a conspiracy of silence. There were so many representatives of the international community on the ground. There were journalists, there were representatives of the United Nations, of the International Red Cross. There were people whose role and task and mission was to report to their relevant headquarters whether or not peace is being achieved in Palestine after the United Nations adopted the partition resolution on the 29th of November 1947. And they knew that instead of peace, from the 1st of February 1948, Jewish troops were going from one house to the other, from village to village, and were expelling by force people, massacring them when they resisted, and looting everything they had, from their material possessions to their cultural heritage, such as books, pictures, photographs, anything they had. Like a locust, they have eaten everything that they have found in their way. And this was seen by many, many people who were not Jews and were not Arabs, who were sent to Palestine to report back home. And they reported back home. We have the reports in the archives. They reported it's a very genuine report. I can say this as a professional historian. I think that they had a very clear picture of the magnitude of the crime that was committed against the people on the ground. But their headquarters, and it doesn't matter whether it was the editorial board of the New York Times, which had a very industrious journalist working for them at the time, who was he was embedded, as you would call it today, with the Jewish forces, and he reported very genuine reports about what was going on. So whether it was the editorial board of the New York Times, whether it was the headquarters of the International Cross in Geneva, or the United Nations Secretariat in New York at the time, they all had received genuine reports of what was going on. And they made a political decision not to publish these reports. They made a very conscious decision not to portray the reality on the ground in Palestine, because it was because there was only one way of depicting it: a crime and an ethnic cleansing. And it doesn't matter whether they would have used the term ethnic cleansing or not. However they would have chosen to represent or summarize the information that they had received from the ground, there was only one simple story to tell. The Jewish forces, later on the Israeli forces, were systematically expelling the Palestinians from their homes, fields, and businesses. Nobody in the Western world wanted to report that story. And when some historians, a year or two later, mainly Palestinians or pro-Palestinians, were trying to say, all right, 2 years later, may we write an academic dissertation about it? May we tell a story about it, have a play about it? They were silenced too. It was suggested to them that so few years after the Holocaust, it's not a good idea to portray the Jews as murderers, expellers, looters, occupiers, and colonizers. This was a conscious decision by the political elites of the West to atone for what Europe did to the Jews in the Second World War. The price was very clear: the dispossession of Palestine. This was the price. It was a simple deal. Instead of facing the real victims, the real Jewish victims of the Nazi Holocaust, which was very difficult, it was much better to deal with the State of Israel instead. It's because the State of Israel wanted only one thing in return for the atonement of the political elites of the West, and especially of Europe. It wanted the right to dispossess the Palestinians. And this right was granted, first by Europe, later by America, and it should be said it was also granted by the Soviet Union, for those of you who have a longing for the Soviet days. It was granted by the Soviet Union as well. In fact, the Soviet Union provided the arms with which the ethnic cleansing was committed. Finally, there was an interesting gap between the political and other political elite. There was an interesting gap between the Palestinian political elite and the behavior of the Palestinian people on the ground in 1948, which should teach us a lesson about what goes on today. One has to preface that and say, of course, that because of the events of 1936 to 1939, the Palestinians in many ways were quite leaderless in 1948. Unfortunately, it's very difficult to think about other chapters in Palestinian history when they were not leaderless. But in 1948, they were particularly leaderless. And the leaders who were they were mostly in exile, found it very difficult to have a united language and a united position, and more or less surrendered their leadership to the Arab League and its leaders. And in fact, if any Palestinians who lived in 1948 on the land of Palestine would have listened to the Palestinian politicians in 1948, worse would have happened. One has to say the truth. They had no idea what to do. They didn't know what to say to their people, even those who had some communication with their people. And they found it very difficult to formulate a position towards an event they did not anticipate. Of course, people now know what can happen. This is the big advantage that we have on 1948. We know what Zionism is all about. I think we understand that the strategy of all the governments of Israel, of all the political parties of Israel, regardless of their position in this charade of an Israeli rainbow of ideas, which doesn't really exist. And we still don't have a united Palestinian leadership. We don't have an address. I've been an activist for the Palestine cause, I think, for more than a quarter of a century, even before that. And if I have to answer questions, especially in initial meetings with people I want to recruit to the Palestine cause, and I would have to give them an address, who should they write to, phone or fax or text, so that they would know what the Palestinian leadership wants us to do? What does it expect us to do? Do you know the address? I don't know the address. We are in a dismal situation where when I go and call for boycott of Israel in London, the Palestinian embassy calls me to say that basically I'm right, but they're not sure this is the right direction. So I have to ask, what is the Palestinian leadership position on boycott? What is the Palestinian leadership position on the right of return? What is the Palestinian leadership position on the one-state solution? How far do they want us to go in the struggle against Zionism in Israel? Do they want us to support the peace process? Do they want us to support the next Annapolis conference? We have to solve these problems. We cannot be bystanders, whoever we are, Jews, Palestinians, Americans. If we are part of that impulse to change the oppressive reality in Palestine, we all have to say that we need a compass. We all have an individual compass, I'm sure. Some of us have spiritual compasses, which is good. We should all have them. But we need a mega compass for all of us, and we don't have it. The Palestinians didn't have it in 1948, and they still don't have it in 2008. So when we learn the history of 1948, we also should learn, and I don't have a formula for you, I don't have a magic formula for you how to do it, but I'm just saying we have to learn the need to find the compass. And some people say, and I think I understand where it comes from, let's put aside the debate between two states and one state. Let's put aside the debate between the Hamas and the Fatah. Let's put aside the debate between the inside and the outside. Let's put aside the debate of what kind of a state we want. If we continue to put all these debates outside, we will be outside as well, eventually. I think this is part of the struggle. Not to defeat each other if we don't agree about something, but to find the golden mean, how to work together on this. But not to hide these things. To find a compass for the next generation of the people who would form the next solidarity committee with Palestine. If something is to be learned from the ANC struggle and the anti-apartheid movement in Europe and in America, was the clear orientation it has received from the ANC. And it was very, very important. And I say this because I really, really, really believe that a clear orientation and clear answers to these questions which we keep saying we'll put aside because we have to move forward, a real answers to these questions will also help us to realize our dream of return, of ending the Zionist regime, of creating a new reality in Palestine for all of us. I really believe in it because I think that it's not enough, and it as important as it is, to feel that eventually evil projects comes to an end, which is true. But for the sake of the people of Gaza, for the sake of the people in Jenin, we don't have the luxury of waiting for this historical lesson to happen just by itself. For their sake, we should find the energy and the power to overcome the internal strifes, to find a direction that would suit all of us, even if it would take a whole year to discuss it, and to tell ourselves that we have the kind of leadership we all want and we all need in order to change the reality for all of us. Thank you very much.
Back to the living here, folks. Okay, as you may have surmised, I was forced to step out here for a rather extended period. Over the last minute or so, heard the end of Ilan Pape's just under 30-minute speech on the Nakba of Palestine. All right, we are up to the line here on the end of Mideast Migraine Show for Monday, February 2nd. Again, because I had to step out of the studio, and this is strictly a pirate radio here. I'm not backed up by anyone for the moment. My apologies if anyone did attempt to make a phone call. I simply wasn't here to take your call. I don't want to discourage people from calling in again. I especially do not want to discourage people from calling in, because I strongly desire and require feedback from my listeners, even if you've only listened this one day, even for a few minutes. I need feedback from you about the direction that you think this program should be going. It is vitally important that I know that more than just a few people are listening, and I generally assume there are, and I truly appreciate the listenership that there is, but either communicate me in the course of my show. Probably shouldn't bother any of the other programmers during their shows, but when I'm doing my Monday show, which comes to you every Monday at 3 p.m. or the Saturday show at 11 a.m. during the break, the mid-program break, each show is about 2 hours long, please call in or communicate with me at MideastMadness@gmx.com. MideastMadness@gmx.com. That's G as in George. But thank you again so much for listening. All the best to you and yours. Tune in next Monday at 3 p.m. or Catch the ending of the reading of Freedom Sailors on Saturday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time. Ta-ta.